Welcome to Richer Life Insights. Our goal is to help you drive more money, motivation, and meaning into your life. So today, I'm going to get some help in helping you achieve that. I'm interviewing Rory Vaden. Now, Rory is an interesting guy because he is a self-discipline strategist. And you're going to learn exactly what that means. And we're also going to talk about his new book that I've read, and I think it's quite fantastic. It's called Take the Stairs, 7 Steps to Achieving True Success. And I read this thing, and like you all know, I read a ton of books, anywhere between, 8 and 10 every month. And this one really stood out to me, so I wanted to talk to him, because I think there is a wealth of information in here that everyone could benefit from. So thank you, Rory, for coming on and sharing your insight with us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Robert. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so like I said, loved the book. It's different than a lot of the other books I've read. It's quite inspirational, yet at the same time, there are some gems of insight in here that I left with and am still thinking about. And so maybe you can first tell us, what is a self-discipline strategist?
Well, I think my passion in life I discovered at a young age, or, you know, that my gift, I guess, or the thing that was very unique about me was that I was able to get myself to do things that I didn't necessarily want to do or didn't like doing, but I could get myself to do them because of the payoff that would result. So a self-discipline strategist is really just, I've basically dedicated my life to figuring out strategies to help people do things that they know they should be doing, but specifically in the moments they don't feel like doing it. So I don't spend so much time telling people how they should live their life. I dive into a very specific little area, which is the moments when you're looking at the escalators and the stairs or the cheesecake and, you know, salad or whatever, and you've got these choices, and you make a decision for yourself personally that you want to do something or that you should do something, but you don't feel like it. What's the psychology of getting yourself to choose that path, to take the stairs, you know, i.e., if you will?
And that is the genius behind this, because, like you said, you're not specific on, well, here's exactly what you need to do or how you need to do it. What you talk about and what you teach and also what you speak about, because you are a world-class speaker, is you talk about how do we do the things that we think we should do and that we know we should do, yet we don't. And that self-discipline, that little piece there is crucial to success, because you can, and we all do this all the time, we know what we should do, yet we are not doing it often. And so what is that psychology? And I know you talk about the 7 steps to achieving success, and so I'd first like to talk about the title of the book, Take the Stairs, because in the early part of the book you talk about the escalator mindset, and which I read as kind of laziness. So maybe you can talk about where you got the idea for the title of the book and how that relates to this escalator mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Take the Stairs as a methodology is a way of thinking. So it's like, I don't tell people what they should do in their life, but it is how to think like the most disciplined people in the world. And so basically, over our work at Southwestern Consulting, so we've got a few hundred people in our coaching program at any given moment. We do one-on-one coaching. And, you know, we've been in over 5,000 offices in the last 5 years. And plus my background at Southwestern, which we'll probably talk a little bit about later, is we started to realize that the most disciplined people in the world, whether the most disciplined with their money, with their fitness, with their ability to make sales calls when they don't want to, people who overcome their fear to start huge companies, it's not that they like discipline more than the rest of us. They realize, number one, that doing the things you don't want to do is the shortest, fastest way to the life of more peace, more happiness. And so they approach their choices and they process their decisions through a different set of criteria than most of us do. So their brain, when they're looking at the stairs and the escalator, as the metaphor goes, most of us, our decision-making process goes like this. Well, you know, I know I should work out, but do I feel like working out right now? And very often the answer is no, and so I don't work out. Or, hey, I know I probably should eat that, but boy, that looks really good, so I'm going to go for that. Or I don't really have the money for this, but I want it, so I'm going to buy it and I'm going to use my credit card. And that's the way most of us make choices and decisions. Well, what we noticed in these people is that they were able mentally to process their choices based on a different set of criteria that made self-discipline easier for them. And so it's not as hard, self-discipline is not as hard as you think when you know how to think about it the right way. And so there's really these seven key insights that the most disciplined people in the world seem to have made that not everybody else has. And that is what became the core, you know, material or content inside of the book.
Okay, and so that's a really important point, because I think for a lot of people, they look at, well, maybe someone who's in shape financially or in shape physically, or who is successful, and they think for whatever reason that, wow, this person must have really enjoyed working out. They just must love to exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Yet what you're saying is that's not necessarily the case. They mm-hmm. may approach the stairs or the escalator and think, well, you know, I should do the stairs and I'm going to do the stairs, even though I really don't want to take the stairs. It's not like I love to do it. I'm just going to do it anyway. In spite of not wanting to, I'm going to do it.
You got it. And that's how it starts. And so, you know, this what we're talking about right here is very closely related to one of the first principles in the book, which is called the paradox principle of sacrifice. And so the paradox principle of sacrifice is that what seems like the easy way, you know, eating whatever we want, saying whatever we want, buying whatever we want, doing whatever we want, whatever is an indulgence in the short term, that seems like the easier thing. It's this immediate gratification. Yet, in the long term, it creates a life of all of these difficult circumstances to live with. You know, we become prisoners of debt, we become unhealthy, we become, you know, it ruins our relationships, and all of these things that we sort of indulge in the short term, they seem easy, but really they're not. And vice versa, the things that seem difficult in the short run, the things that we don't want to do, we don't want to eat the you know, the healthy food, we don't want to save our money, we don't and buy with cash, we don't want to go to the gym. And yet when we do those things in the short term, that creates the easier life, the much easier life in the long run. And so it shifts the perspective for how we enter into the choice. And so the paradox principle, just simply stated, is easy short-term choices lead to difficult long-term consequences, and inversely, difficult short-term choices lead to easy long-term consequences.
And this particular paradox really, really resonated with me. I mean, it jumped out on the page, because For years and years and years, this is something that I've internalized. I didn't really even think about it, actually. But when I read it, I just started looking back at some of my past decisions. Mm-hmm. And this principle was always at the forefront, even though I didn't really recognize it. You know, I would see friends going out, taking vacations, doing all these things, and I was kind of stuck at home, maybe on the weekends at night, working on a book. And mm-hmm. I would think, gosh, you know, they're having all this fun, they're doing all these great things. But I knew if I put in the time that in the long term, I would benefit. And mm-hmm. and you have a quote in here that I just love, and it's, choices that are easy in the short term are very often in direct conflict with what makes life easy in the long term. And so that, it's such a compelling insight to have. Focus on doing the tough stuff now, because it's going to be easier in the future.
You got it. And so that becomes the whole motivation for making a choice to take the stairs, because, like we said, it's not that you're doing it because you enjoy pain. It's because it's the opposite. It's because you want an easier life. You want more freedom. You want richer relationships. You want more money. And we don't realize that is how the choices are made. And here's one thing that it did not include in the book, but came out of one of the interviews. As you know, we there were several ultra performers, as our publisher called them, that were profiled. So some of them were our top coaching clients. Some of them were just people that we met. And one gentleman who was included in the book, who happens to be particularly wealthy, he sold two companies for over $200 million each by age 39. He explained to me the difference in how poor people think, middle income people think, and rich people think. And this rocked my world, and it got cut from the book for whatever reason. But I grew up in trailer parks and apartments all around Boulder, Colorado, and was raised by a single mother. And you know, when he explained this to me, it really changed the way that I processed my own choices personally. So here's what he said. He said, think about when you go to buy a coffee at Starbucks, and the coffee is $5. When we all walk in and we all say, "Ooh, I want a coffee. A coffee would be really good right now." Okay, all three classes of people have that thought, but then the ensuing piece of information or question that they ask to make their decision is different. So what a poor person does, as he described it, was, you know, whether or not they have the money, they're going to get the coffee because they want it. They will borrow the money. They will steal the coffee. They will beg for the coffee. They will put it on debt. They will do whatever to get the coffee because that's what they want right now. And it's that, you know, short term. And what most people do with their choices, and particularly, you know, with their money in this example, is they look at the coffee and they say, well, do I want the coffee? Well, yeah, of course I want the coffee. Do I have $5? Yeah, I have $5. So let's get the coffee. And here's my $5 and I'll take the coffee. And it's a very normal way of thinking. It's a very, average by definition, or the way that most people think. So the way that a wealthy person processes the decision is, he said, when I look at a $5 coffee, I realize if I spend $5 on the coffee, that's $5 that I'm not investing into myself. I'm not investing into a business or something that will help my business, and that's $5 I'm not investing into, say, you know, like a good growth stock mutual fund. And so the empirical example that he explained was, he said, okay, so if I took five bucks and found a good growth stock mutual fund over history at maybe around 12%, he said, that $5 20 years from now would be worth $25. So the question he asks is not, do I have $5 to get the coffee? The question is this $5 coffee worth $25 to me 20 years from now? Now, he might still choose to get the coffee. And that is why, on the surface, it is so hard to see two people who look the same, sound the same, even making the same choice in a particular instance, yet the trajectory of their lives is completely different, because it's not necessarily the decision they made that is the important part. It is how they made the decision, and our endurance is directly proportionate to the term of our perspective. So the longer perspective we have, the more it deadens the temptation of the short-term indulgence.
I would love to read that profile of this particular person. Is this something that you've actually made available?
Well, the profile of the gentleman made it into the book, but that part did not. So he is a guy named Sean Wolfington, and he is the entrepreneur that is out of Florida. And Sean is just a gentleman that I met out speaking at a conference. We actually spoke together. He was one of the other speakers. And I heard his story. I was like, wow, what an incredible person. And so his profile did make it in the book, but that part of the story did not. And so it's not something that I've written about. But, you know, there's Darren Hardy in his book, The Compound Effect, writes about a similar kind of a, decision-making process or framework. So, but, you know, we can apply that to our lives. And one of the things I love that you said, Robert, is you said, you know, looking back on my life, I see how this applied. And what's really great about the Take the Stairs methodology is, when you read it, it's like, it's not like earth-shattering in terms of, hey, this is rocket science. It's more enlightening in terms of articulating things that we all know, but we haven't consciously stated.
Yeah, and you know, I would even argue that it's better than rocket science, because rocket science is extremely complicated and it's not very very applicable. This, you look at it and you read it and you go, okay, I get it, it makes sense, and it's something that you can start implementing immediately. And so that's what I appreciate about it.
Yeah, well,
now,
thank you.
One of the other sort of steps is this idea of commitment. And you've got a really clever story about someone who forces commitment upon himself that I'll let the readers read themselves, because it's clever and it's very funny. But you make a note in here that you say that we need to stop spending so much of our time trying to make the right decision and instead start spending our time making decisions and then simply making them right.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I just love that idea, because I think so many of us can get bogged down on, well, what is the right thing to do? Is this right? Is that not right? And analyzing it and talking to people about it, and should I do it? Shouldn't I do it? What's the right way? What if it's the wrong way? And we just get so hung up on what is the quote-unquote right way to do this.
Yeah.
And you're saying, you know, forget that. Just get started. Do something. And then eventually make some changes and make that decision the right one. Because you don't often start off with the right decision. It's something that gets shaped and formed into the right decision.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, where I really gained the most, I think, value to understand and sort of present this concept was from looking at marriages and successful marriages. And that's one of the things that's interesting about this whole take the stairs methodology, is that it applies to all these different areas of our life, our marriages and relationships, and you know, our finances, our spirituality, our health, and particularly in the realm of relationships. You know, when you look at you know, being married, you know, making the right decision about marriage, that's a big commitment. It's this big choice, and yet when you talk to people who have maybe you know, people who have been married for a long time. And you ask them, you say, well, you know, have you ever, you know, wanted to get a divorce? I mean, have you always been happy? Has it always been this blissful thing? And people that have been married for 40 or 50 years will say, no, it's been an absolute nightmare. It's been hard. It's been painful. But that is irrelevant to the fact that I made a commitment. And so the commitment isn't based on the conditions of our circumstances. The commitment is made, and then the circumstances are forced to mold around the commitment.
Absolutely, and it really goes to show that in this quote you have here, that changing from the question should I to how will I is the mindset shift that makes all the difference. And I've already used this on my 6-year-old daughter. it's getting to the point of not if, but how. And that's the beauty. It's looking at the solution, not figuring out if there is a solution, but what is the solution?
Yeah, you got it. And so, you know, the commitment continuum, which is the diagram or the framework that's a part of this chapter on this principle related to commitment, shows visually that the way that most of us, when it comes to evaluating whether or not we keep our decisions, we say, you know, should I stay or should I go? Should I, you know, make this work or should I not? Should I invest this time? Should I invest this money? And it comes back again to, like, you know, is this the right decision? And yet the people who are incredibly successful, it's not that they have absolute certainty about that it's the right decision, but the attitude that they approach it with is, well, how will I make this work? How will we get this company off the ground? How are we going to save this marriage? How
is key. How is absolutely key. It completely changes how you think about it. I mean,
yeah.
When you say how, all of a sudden your mind starts trying to find a solution, and that's exactly what you're looking for.
Yeah, you got it. And another important insight related to this is there's when we're evaluating our commitments, there's two different types of energy that are expended. And the one that most of us think about is physical energy. So going back to like a working out, if we made a commitment to lose weight this year, and so here we are coming up on February 1st, 30 days past our New Year's resolution, and many of us made a commitment like that, when it comes time to actually go to the gym, most of us evaluate our decision to keep that commitment based on physical energy, i.e., do I feel like going to the gym? And very often the answer to that question is no, and so then we do not go to the gym. Well, what we learned from these ultra performers, and also over Southwestern's 155-year history, you know, going back and analyzing some of our sister companies and their legacy of success, is that these other type of people, these ultra performers, realize there's another type of energy involved in evaluating decisions, which is emotional energy. And there is an emotional energy simply in making the decision that masks the physical energy that is really there. And oftentimes the emotional energy of making the decision is much greater than the physical energy required to execute the decision. So, in other words, like when you're thinking about going to the gym, it's not getting yourself onto the treadmill once you're at the gym that's the hard part. It's when you're sitting on the couch deciding whether or not you should even go.
And so I just want to make sure that I understand this, because I think this is a pretty important insight. It's that for a lot of these decisions, it's not necessarily the difficult part is not necessarily the physical energy, the physical feeling of, do I have the energy to do this task, whatever it is. But it's that emotional shift of, I'm going to do it. Is that what you're talking about?
It's really just the insight of realizing that you've got more physical energy than you feel like you do in those moments. But it is clouded by the energy that is being expended in just making a tough decision. So, you know, if you're a salesperson and you are looking at the phone and you know you need to make a sales call, and yet we have this fear of the rejection and this huge story in our head about, oh, what if they say no? What if they yell at me? What if I don't get through? I don't like this. This isn't fun. And so there's this huge story that takes off in our mind that keeps us from physically grabbing the phone and dialing the numbers. Well, what you find when you do pick up the phone and dial the numbers is that the moment that somebody answers and you're talking to them, it is not nearly as bad or as hard as we made it out to be. And the physical energy shows up often once we get into the situation. So it's the emotional mental story that we create in the decision making process that clouds our whole picture of what's really there and what we really have, what power and energy we really have available to us.
Got it. So how then, in that moment, we're either sitting at the desk, you know, in our minds trying to play a game on ourselves of whether we're going to pick up the phone or not, or we're on the couch thinking, should I go to the gym or shouldn't I? How can we shift that mindset and just do it?
Well, there are two key things probably here. So one would be to just stop thinking about it. I mean, literally, the insight of realizing that, look, it's my mind is making this much worse than it is, and just knowing that that is the truth, sort of, it's almost like you go, oh, that's silly, and you just pick up the phone and you make the call. The other thing that you can do, and this is a general strategy for any short-term decision that is difficult, is you want to leverage long-term vision to endure short-term sacrifices. You leverage long-term vision to endure short-term sacrifices. So in that moment, what happens is we get so caught up in the here and now, oh my gosh, I don't want to make the phone call, or oh my gosh, I don't feel like working out. But in that moment, if you think about, you know, like going to the phone call example, if you really stop for a second and you think about, hey, the reason why I'm working so hard is because I know that my bonus check this month is going to go to my kid's college fund. And that is why I need to crank it right now, and that is why this matters. And you take a second to get present to what really matters to you in the long run. What happens is the short-term sacrifice or activity loses its power, and it pales in comparison to the vision. So oftentimes, people who are struggling with self-discipline, It's not that they have a lack of discipline or a lack of work ethic. In many cases, it's that they have a lack of vision. They don't have a clear enough picture about what they want in their life, and it's not compelling enough for them to pull them through the muck.
Yeah, you know, one of my, I think I wrote this in the other 8 hours maybe, is that I don't think people are lazy, I just don't think they're sufficiently motivated. Or inspired, you know. It goes to exactly what you're saying. I think if we have a compelling enough future, we will pretty much endure anything in the short term.
And in
talking and profiling all these successful folks, did you find a way or two that they typically either created that vision or reminded themselves of that vision in the moment?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of practical things. So, you know, one of the most common trends here recently is to have like a vision board. So,
yeah.
And that concept of a vision board can show up in several different ways. Some people have a binder, you know, that they would, before they sit down to make the cold calls, for example, they pull out their binder and they flip through and they look at pictures of things they want or maybe a list of something they want. Other people will put a picture on the fridge, and there's two pictures you can put up. One is towards motivated and one's away motivated, but you know, they see the image of this person on the fridge, and it causes them to move out of this short-term moment and evaluate the choices that they're about to make with the longer-term perspective. There's some people just do it inherently. They have such a driving focus in their life. There is something that they are constantly thinking about so much. Like one of the guys that we profiled is a guy named Chad Goldwasser. And Chad is one of our coaching clients. We worked with him for 18 months. And he was out of 72,000 real estate agents in the world for Keller Williams. He was the number one agent out of 72,000. And when you talk to him about that experience and people that are like that, that have accomplished just some amazing thing, you realize it's not that they have some superpower or some lucky break that makes it happen. It's that it was all they thought about. It was almost in a weird way, like an all-consuming focus of this is what I'm going after. And that pulls them through. And, you know, another great example is for the people who are listening to this. A real common question that I get, Robert, is, so, you know, this whole book's about procrastination and overcoming entitlement and creative avoidance and that. And so people will say, well, what about my kids? You talk about entitlement. They don't want to work for anything. so what's the explanation there? And I say, well, you know, I disagree. I don't think that there's like a lack of work ethic necessarily in young people, because here's the proof. If you find a kid that loves skateboarding, the kid will be out at the skate park 8 hours a day every single weekend.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
If you find a kid that loves editing videos, they will literally stay up till 2 a.m. every morning on school night posting videos on YouTube. And it's because So they do have that commitment, they do have that discipline for the things that they care about, so it's really not such a lack of work ethic as much as it's a lack of vision. Because if you don't have a long-term vision, if there's not a strong connection to how the sacrifices you are asking yourself to make today, or that somebody else is asking you to make today, if there's not a strong connection between how those sacrifices today will forward you to that vision, it becomes hard for anybody to take action. But if there is a strong correlation between the sacrifices I'm being asked to make today to the thing that I want in the future, it's like I don't even notice that what I'm doing today is a sacrifice, because all I'm thinking about is that future.
Yeah, that is so powerful. I think if people can really internalize that and start doing some of these things that you talked about, maybe the vision board or just reminders or a list, a binder, that it really does work. I mean, if you can create that compelling future, that compelling vision for the future, and remind yourself of that, it can help you power through any sort of cold call that you have to make.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is so much great information here. I just want to talk about one more thing, and for the folks listening, you got to get the book. Again, it's called Take the Stairs. And you can actually read more about the book and more about Rory at takethestairsbook.com. But there's one more thing, and that is the three faces of inaction. It's all about what's holding you back. And the three sort of attitudes of inaction are fear, entitlement, and perfectionism. And so what you're saying is that when people do not take action, it is because of one or more of these three attitudes?
Yeah, those are some of the most common. It's those are some of the real most common ones. So, like, you know, fear is basically the attitude is I'm scared to do it. I'm scared to do this. And, you know, basically the attitude, the productive attitude that we noticed in performers is that their attitude is one is, okay, we'll do it scared. So it's kind of like, it's okay to be scared, just do it scared.
Okay.
Like the fact that you're scared in no way prohibits your ability to do it. And and my mom used to always tell me, you know, I was trying to joke that I learned about self-discipline at a young age because when I was 5 years old, my mom put me into martial arts, and by age 10, I had become the youngest black belt in Colorado to ever get beaten up by a girl.
Nice.
And so I used to fight with my mom because I would say, Mom, I don't like this. I don't enjoy this. This isn't fun for me. And she would always say, that's okay, Rory. Enjoying it isn't a requirement of doing it.
That is awesome. I love that. I mean, not that you got beat up, Rory. I don't love that. But your mom certainly had some great advice for you there.
Yeah, well, there you go. Just put it on Twitter. Enjoying it is not a requirement of doing it, / Rory's mom.
Beat up by girl. How about that? Let's
beat
use that hashtag.
So that's fear. Then entitlement is I shouldn't have to do it. And entitlement is this disgusting disease that destroys our ability to reach our dreams. Because entitlement is just somewhere flat out where just the chutzpah of all of this comes in. The reason why I say entitlement is this disgusting thing is because it's one thing if we're not successful because we don't know what to do, or we don't have the skills to do it, or we don't have the resources to do it, or, you know, it's just not physically possible for us to do it. It is a completely another to say, I know exactly what to do. I have all the resources I would need to have, or I could get them. I have the skill to do it. I simply just don't have the will to do it. And that is like, you know, so it's just understanding that mentality is just flat out holding you back, and you got to let go of it. But I will say, of these, you know, these three, it is the last one that I find is the most common and pervasive in middle America.
Really? And then that's the perfectionism one.
It is the perfectionism one. I mean, there's some things that we're just flat out scared and we all have our fears and stuff. But for the average, what keeps the average person average in most cases is it's not that they don't care about, like, it's part of it is procrastination, which is a huge part of what the whole book is about, although we haven't talked too much about it here. But the reason why most of us procrastinate on things that we know we should do and we know we need to do and we know that would help us, it is not because we don't care about success, and it's not because we don't care about letting people down or letting ourselves down. It's that we care so much about success. We care so much about making the people around us proud. We care so much about wanting to live up to our potential that we just want to make sure that we have the perfect plan before we get started, that we have the perfect amount of time, that is the perfect time, that it's the perfect decision, that it's we have the perfect amount of money. And so we want to make sure to wait to get started until we have that perfect plan. And unfortunately, we don't realize that the perfect time never comes, And because of something we talk about in the book called the Law of Diminishing Intent, with each moment that passes by that we don't get started, the likelihood that we ever will decreases exponentially.
So true.
Yeah, it starts to, and then it slips away, and one day we wake up and we look back at our life and we go, how did I end up so far away from where I wanted to be? And it's like an overwhelming feeling. And here's what's crazy. You know, so many of these ultra performers, you know, like in our mind, we create these stories like, oh gosh, they just must be geniuses and they just must be workaholics, or gosh, you know, they all must be the sons and daughters of just rich people that can open the doors and just make stuff happen. And it's always funny to me how, you know, my own stories about success get exploded as I meet real successful people and just ask them about their story. And when it comes to perfection, the strategy that these people use is so ridiculously simple-minded and basic, and it's so glaringly obvious that it's totally elusive, and that is that these ultra performers, they are relentless about making progress. They are ruthless and uncompromising about making progress. They absolutely demand that themselves and the people around them will make progress, and yet at the exact same time, they completely free themselves of the demand for perfection.
That's powerful. That is powerful. So they don't focus so much on the end result being perfect. It's simply whatever they're doing, they're just trying to get a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. It's like you embrace the idea that success is messy. The path to whatever you want is always messy. It never goes as planned. It's all about course correction. And I'm sure when you set out, you might have a goal or a dream that, hey, I want to write a New York Times bestselling book. But if you waited until you had all of the exact perfect plan laid out and you knew for sure it was going to work, you would have never gotten started. What happens is you walk through one door, and every time you walk through a door, another door opens. Or, you know, to make it ridiculously cliche, you take one step at a time, as you take the stairs, and, you know, with each step you take, the next one becomes more obvious. And even though, you know, you may not be going up a straight path, you eventually get there.
And so, Rory, you are basically a world champion of public speaking through the Toastmasters. And that is an enormous, enormous achievement. And I'm wondering, when you got started, if you had this fear of perfectionism and this fear of failure, right? You have to get up and you have to give a speech, and what if you're not good, and what if they don't like me, what if they laugh, blah, blah, blah. But somehow you were able to overcome that, giving hundreds of speeches, and become a world champion. So what was your approach to overcoming this fear of, I don't know if it's perfectionism or if it's this fear of failure. It's I guess it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
How were you able to overcome that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I appreciate it. And you know, the truth is, as you alluded to, that out of the 25,000 contestants in the contest, I was second. So as Jerry Seinfeld would say, I was the number one loser. And but it was a huge feat and a huge moment of my life, and it was incredibly scary. I mean, I remember being at the point of tears because I wanted to be a speaker so bad, and I wanted to spend my life doing this, but I was 22 years old, and I was like, how at 22 years old, I mean, who would ever listen to me? Like, who would pay attention to some kid, and where would I have any credibility? And so I thought, well, you know, wow, maybe if I won the world championship of public speaking, yeah, maybe somebody would listen to me. Maybe that would give me the credibility to go out and do this. And so, but it was overwhelming, because it's like my whole dream here is on the line, and this is the only viable thing that at that time I could see as the way to get there. And yet, you know, nobody had ever won. I mean, there were people who would spend 15 or 20 years dedicating their life to this contest. And so, you know, basically is, You learn when you throw yourself at something to put your self-esteem into your work habits rather than your actual outcomes. And that was something I had learned at Southwestern. When I was in college, I sold books door-to-door, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week on straight commission during my 5 summers in college and graduate school for a company called Southwestern, who's the parent company of Southwestern Consulting, our company now. And that was one thing they taught us, is you always put your self-esteem in your work habits, not into your outcomes. And so when it came to the World Championship, it was like, I don't know if I will win. I'm terrified that I won't. And the more scared I was, the more that became fuel to just, what I do know I can do is go out and speak as much and as often as possible if I do it for free. And so I cold called high schools, I went to comedy clubs, churches, Lions clubs, Key clubs, Rotary clubs, Toastmaster clubs, I mean, anybody who would give me stage time. And I remember driving from my parents' house at the time, which was Longmont, Colorado, down to Colorado Springs, which is about a 2-hour drive. I would drive 2 hours to get 5 minutes of stage time.
Now that is dedication.
And drive back. But here's the thing, it's when you have that mindset of how, because is it possible for a 22-year-old to win the world championship? I don't know. I don't know if it's possible. Is it possible to write a New York Times best-selling book? I don't know if that's possible. But what I do know is anybody who's ever done anything great, when you approach whatever the endeavor is that you want and you carry that mindset of how, it's like your mind transcends all limitations. You break free of these belief barriers and these mental prisons that of our own construction that we come up with about what is possible and what isn't possible. And we do this thing, most of us, where we decide, well, what's possible for my future is based on my past, and your past has nothing to do with your future.
Amen to that. That is so true. And you know, there's a Dr. Scott Miller. He's a psychologist, and he's done a lot of research looking at high performers, ultra performers, in all areas. And the thing that he says distinguishes them from everyone else, two things. They put in a little bit more time, but even if they didn't put in more time, they engage in what he calls deliberate practice. And so I'm wondering, in your quest to become a world champion speaker, and you did, 300-400 of these speaking engagements, what you did after each speech, did you have a format where you analyzed what went well, what went wrong, and how you could tweak it? How did you basically rise up the ranks and basically get something from those 300-400 speeches?
Well, it's funny that you asked that question. I've never been asked that question, but it is a hugely important part of what happened is I did. I recorded every single one of those speeches, and I went back and watched every one after I did it. And I used to watch the film 4 different ways. This was something that I learned from somebody who did actually win the world championship, a buddy of mine named Ed Tate, who won the world championship in 2000. And Ed said the way you should watch your film is 4 different ways. So what I would do is I would watch it once, and I would watch it on mute. And so I would watch it on mute so I could just analyze my gestures and my body language and not be focused on anything else related to the speech. So I'm just watching my gestures. Then I would watch it again. So I'd rewind it, watch it again. And that time I'd watch it with my back to the screen so that I could only hear it.
Nice.
So then I was just listening to the words that I was saying. Then I would watch it on fast forward, which is really peculiar, but the reason you watch it on fast forward is because if you have a nervous tic, like you twirl your hair,
yeah,
or you smack your lips, or you always pace back and forth, or you do something weird with your foot, you don't notice it in normal speed, but in fast forward it becomes really obvious because you just see this motion happening over and over.
Very cool.
And then the last and final way is you watch it normal. You just watch it regular, and you see how the whole thing comes together. And so you start to pick apart all of these, these different elements of the whole process. And that's – but, I learned that technique from Ed, and had I waited to know that information before I got started, that piece of information would have never showed up. The way it showed up was by committing to this, you know, being scared, doing it anyway, say, okay, I'm definitely doing this. How is this going to happen? Focusing on progress over perfection, so you start moving down the path, and then that's what happens, is as you move down the path, important pieces of information, new people, new opportunities, the things that you need show up as you're moving down the path.
Right, right. You didn't start doing it the right way. You did it, and then you've tweaked it and made it right.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, this is just fantastic. I love this book. It's Take the Stairs. And maybe you can talk just a bit about this fantastic tour that you're doing across the country.
Yeah, well, it's so here's discipline applied again in my life. Okay, so you know, first we had the black belt thing, and then we had this, you know, getting a scholarship to college, and then it was Southwestern, the experience of Southwestern, and becoming a top, you know, door-to-door salesperson, basically, and then it was the World Championship of Public Speaking. And so, you know, my new thing right now is, you know, not to be shy about it, I want to be a New York Times best-selling author. And so, you know, I've had dozens of people who know me, who have seen the track record, say, it's not possible, you can't do it. As a first-time author, you know, nobody knows who you are, you're not on TV, because they're like, if you're going to be a New York Times best-selling author, it's like, you got to be a politician, you got to be a superstar athlete, you got to be a celebrity, you got to be Snooki, you know, something. and they're like, that's not you. And so I said, well, how? How does it, I mean, there's got to be some way. How does it happen? And so we came up with, you know, we discovered that there's a certain number of sales you got to create, you know, to give yourself a good shot. And so what we then said is, okay, so how are we going to create these sales? And so we came up with this strategy, and we said, well, what if we work with local schools across the country, and we offer to have me come speak for free, and the school gives us their auditorium, and they can invite the entire community, and we want it to be a family event where parents can come with their teenagers, like eighth grade and up, to learn the seven principles here of self-discipline that are part of the Take the Stairs methodology. And they come for free, and then we'll collect a suggested donation of $10 at the door per person, and then we'll give 100% of that money back to the local school.
Nice.
So what happens is the school raises some money, the parents and the kids get the free education, and all of a sudden I get in front of an audience of people to sort of inspire them, but also make my case that this is worthwhile. And it, you know, the idea is just caught on like wildfire, because schools need money, kids and adults need self-discipline alike, and you know, we basically said, hey, let's just do this. And so anyways, we have 20 events coming up in back-to-back days, and so we're going to be in a tour bus. So from February 20th to March 20th of 2012, so this is right around the corner, we're going to start in Nashville, and then we're going all across the country to 20 different states, and we're doing these events. They're free. People can register at takethestairsbook.com. All of the 20 events are listed right there. They can sign up, register their teens, come to an event. If nothing else, it'll be a lot of fun, and if they can't afford the $10, we still want them to come. And we're going to have a good time, and who knows if we'll sell any books, but what I do know is we're likely to raise some money and hopefully impact some people, and that's reason enough to do it.
I love it, Rory, and I got to tell you, anyone who's listening to this, all of my members, everyone in this community who want a richer life, honestly, I cannot recommend this book enough, and clearly after having listened to Rory, I'm sure you get just the kind of information and the kind of insight. And there's so much more in this book. So check it out. You can go to takethestairsbook.com. You can read more about Rory, his amazing background, his consulting business. You can read about this book tour that he's doing. Sign up, go to it. I know I'm going to be there. So again, thank you so much for your time and insight and just all of the great work that you're doing.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure and a privilege, and thank you for the compliment of reading the book, having me, and just having the passion for this. It's just so exciting to be a part of it.
Great. Well, I'll see you on the stage soon then.
Yes, I will see you in the stairwell, people.